Thanks everyone for being here. Yeah, I would have loved to visit PI and get to meet you and chat with you a bit more. But yeah, unfortunately I had some teaching duty, but I also didn't want to postpone that talk too much. So here I am. Hopefully we can have a nice hour or so together. Yeah, I'll be discussing this colorful yet dark mirror solutions on the strong CP problem. I added these two words to the title to stress that I'll be discussing dark matter at some point in the context of this model. And also, yeah, this colorful refers to the fact that we're going to play some games with the color part of the sample gauge group. Yeah, so this is where done in collaboration with Lawrence Hall at Berkeley, whom I'm sure you all know, Claudio and Christiana, who are both postdocs at Berkeley, and some follow-up with the same people and Amara McCoon, who's currently graduating grad students from UCSB. Okay, I thought that I would start, since the talk is about the strong CP problem, I figured that I may need to reintroduce what it means, or in case some of you are not familiar with it. If you're all experts, I apologize, you're going to be bored in the next couple of minutes. Yeah, so the strong CP problem is associated with the way the star model breaks CP as we know it. So all the CP variation that we've observed so far comes from the CKM matrix, which is unitary and therefore complex. And hence it contains some CP odd part. However, there's another piece in the standard model of Cranjan that we could write that has also a CP odd part. It's this topological density of the gluon field strength. So there is this parameter here, theta bar, which because of the presence of this epsilon tensor here is both P and CP odd. However, the effect of this term have not been observed yet, which is at the core of the strong CP problem. I'll make that a bit more precise and quantified in a second before I wanted to rephrase this in another language that I'm going to use later on in the talk. So I'm going to say the same things in another field basis, in another representation of the standard model, which is the one that is in use when you want to deal with the phase of the standard model, which is the unbroken phase when the Higgs does not yet have a VEV, for instance, that is useful at high energies or at high temperature. So in that case, the fermions are arranged in gauge multiplets, the gauge interactions are diagonal, and all of the flavor content, and in particular, all of the CP violation, the one of the CKM mechanism, is to be found in these 3x3 arbitrary matrices that are these two Yukawa matrices. And now we have there's a big redundancy associated with this description. Namely, you can choose to reshuffle and relabel which one is the first, the second, and the third kind of left-handed quark, for instance, the same for up and down. So there is a large U3 to the 5 freedom associated to unphysical parameters that you can use that transform the Yukawa matrices, for instance, in this way for the up Yukawa. So now you're looking for physical parameters, and those physical parameters, if they are physical, they should be the same in all of these different field bases, which means that you can build objects called flavor invariants to capture them. And for instance, the CKM phase is in one-to-one correspondence with that object here called the Yarskog invariant, which you can convince yourself is flavor invariant given those transformation of these two quark Yukawas. And it's the only thing in the star model that you can write that uses the star model Yukawas, and that is imaginary. So this thing is what captures the CKM phase. And as we've said a slide ago, there is a second object in the star model that we sometimes don't discuss at the level of textbooks, which is this. So this is another flavor invariant combination of the different parameters that two things is Lagrangian. So there is this, what I would call bare theta angle here. And there is this extra contribution coming from the quarks, and that arises because of the quantum anomalies that say that the theta angle and this object shifts when you do an abelian transformation among those U3 in a way that precisely cancels. So this thing is also a physical parameter. And yeah, we've not seen it. So all known CP violating phenomena that we've observed seem to be CKM driven. And there's a question which stands, which is where are the effects driven by this theta bar? Of course, you may think, well, maybe those effects are just like small and observable. So, but it's not the case. It's not immediate. It's not completely straightforward to see because this operator here is completely invisible in perturbation theory because it's a total derivative. So you can write it as partial mu of some vector k mu. Nevertheless, it has non-perturbative effects. And those effects are the strongest when you go to energy regions where the strong force is the strongest. And when you look, of course, at CPV observables, which could be proportional to this CP violating parameter here. So naturally, the kind of observables that could be sensitive to that could be significantly sensitive to this theta bar parameter are the EDMs of at low energies, for instance, of bound states of QCD, such as the neutron. So yeah, the electric dipole moment is the coefficient of the neutron is the coefficient of that operator in the low energy EFT, describing the coupling of new neutron to the photon field strength. And yeah, you can estimate how much of an EDM you would get if that parameter were round, and you would get the following answer. You'd get that the EDM is predicted to be around that value. At the same time, we've been looking for that EDM and we've not found it, putting a very sharp bound on what it is currently, which is at this level. So if you put the two together, you find that this parameter has to be at as small as 10 to the minus 10. So this thing that we based on just gauge invariance and the symmetry of the star model could be order one, however it happens to be that small. So that's the precise statement of the strong CP problem. Oh, by the way, I haven't said it, but I guess it comes without saying, but feel free to interrupt and ask questions throughout the talk. That would be for the best. Okay, so as any standard model puzzle, it has lots of solutions, which all answer the question, what kind of new physics beyond the standard model could set this theta bar quantity to zero, at least at low energies? And I'd like to first stress that if you like to think about physics from the bottom up, like an effective field theorist, this problem has unpleasing or at least surprising features. So one thing you may naively think is that, well, whatever physics is doing the job, it's going to be too heavy because otherwise its effects are going to be suppressed, decoupled. However, it's not the case here. We are dealing with the dimension 4 operator and which receives non-decoupling or threshold contributions at all scales. So the solution that the kind of physics that sets theta bar to zero to energies could be at very high scale or could even be like distributed over many scales. A second thing you may expect is, well, okay, let's say there are some physics at high scale that sets theta bar to zero at some scale. Well, this specific value, theta bar equals zero, is not protected by anything in the star model. For instance, it would be the point that preserves CP and P. However, those two symmetries are badly broken in the star model. So you expect that quantum corrections would make theta bar deviate from the value you set at the high scale. And it happens also in that it does not happen actually in the standard model. The quantum corrections to theta bar are actually quite extremely weak. So in the standard model, this result is due to Ellis and Gaillard in their seminal paper. And they've shown, for instance, that the RGs of this theta angle vanish up to seven loops. And you have finite corrections at the weak scale, which vanish until three loops. So if you estimate those contributions, you find things which are orders of magnitude below what we can possibly see in the near future. So yeah, this thing, if this thing happens to be set to zero at a very high scale, and it's going to stay roughly equal to zero, and you won't notice the difference at low energies. So you may think, okay, well, that's annoying. How will I know? So there's no hope of finding this, and then you would be happy to know that there are solutions that are completely agnostic about whatever happens in the UV, which I would call IR solutions. And they're of two kinds, two big categories, those that make the theta angle unphysical and those that make it dynamical. So in the first kind is what I would call massless quark solutions to the strong CP problem that basically use the fact that if you had a massless quark in the standard model, this determinant would be zero because one of the Yukawa matrices would not be full rank, and the argument would be ambiguous. Another way of saying this is that there's no way of defining a flavor invariant quantity that describes the theta angle, and it's therefore physical. However, this solution that would have been very nice is actually ruled out currently by Lattice data. Something else which most of you no and love, I'm sure, is the axion solution to the strong CP problem, the so-called Pecci-Quinn solution, where this condition here, theta bar being zero, can be understood as the fact that there is a dynamical field whose minimum, whose VEV happens to sit at the vacuum where it's actually zero. And the great thing about this is that if you were just to introduce that kind of coupling, so you really promote this theta angle to a dynamical field, the dynamics of QCD would be sufficient to ensure that the vacuum actually is at zero. It's a great consistent solution. And it comes also with a great benefit that it gives you for free a dark matter quantity.
So I have a question. So what the lattice precisely does, how it's ruled out? How does it rule out the first solution?
Okay, so I've never looked into this in detail, but my understanding is that they match spectra and so on of things we see in the hadronic spectrum and just tell us that it's inconsistent with mu being zero. I think that's what they do. Okay. Like that they would run simulation with, I think, I'm not sure someone knows that better than me in this room, but I guess they run simulation with mu equals zero and they get the spectras which are just not compatible with what we observe or something like this.
Right, so it's not that they can directly kind of measure this Newton bar, no? That's something, it's not something which you can, or you can kind of measure it on the lattice. I mean, not related to the masses of the quarks, because yeah, that may be complicated, but just somehow determine directly this quantity, would it be, kind of, is it feasible? Determine directly to the bar somehow on the lattice. Well, of course, it will depend on the input. Okay, yeah, maybe that's the same.
So yeah, I'm not sure I understood everything you said, but I think that's what I would have said. With some observed, you would see it as an output given some constraint that fits on data. I should stress that these things should also be thought of as inspirational, and there are some minimal, non-minimal model building that still use that kind of thinking and are not ruled out. But the most minimal solution is ruled out of that sort here. Anyway, these things are not what I wanted to tell you about today. They are some other solutions to the strong CP problem. And today I wanted to focus on another class, which basically leverages those features and turns them into a solution. So basically you're saying, oh, great, there could be physics at a high scale that consistently with the fact that we've not seen it, that nevertheless solve the strong CP problem. So let's go for it. Let's look for those models and see what they tell us. And those models basically all follow the same logic, which is just make theta equal zero at some high scale. And the way to do it is to use symmetries. So the theta angle would be forbidden if P or CP were exact symmetries in the UV. So you just have to postulate that and you get yourself a boundary condition in the UV of that sort. So those are the kind of model that discuss. Those are those parity solutions with the strong CP problem. And of course, neither P nor CP are symmetries of the star model, of its low energy dynamics. So they must be, if they're exact in the UV, they must be somehow spontaneously broken in the deep ion. In the class of model that have been the most studied, I think, the so-called Nelson-Barr models, you break CP by having some kind of extra field in the UV that gets a valve that introduces in the model that only has real parameters, a complex parameter. So you generate some complex number spontaneously out of the vacuum expectation value of some field. So I think that's extremely schematically how Nelson-Barr models work. So there's a great body of literature on those that I've not even tried to reference here. Maybe some of you are doing this or have done this. I'll focus on the other kind of symmetries that we can use, which is parity in the UV. So the theta angle was both P and CP odd. So any of the two would do the job to make it zero at high energies. So I'll be discussing those parity symmetries to the strong CP problem. And to try to build up towards why we build models like this, let's discuss together let's remind ourselves why parity is not a symmetry of the star model, which I guess you all know, but let me say it nevertheless. So you can phrase it in two ways, which are interconnected, right? Either for each set of gauge charges, you have only half a Dirac fermion charge with the appropriate gauge charges, or you could say differently, for every Dirac fermion in the IR, it happens that the left and the right-handed piece don't transform in the same way under the SU2 left. So that suggests that if you wanted a theory that has parity in the UV, well, why not adding new fermions? So for instance, what you would need is a parity flipped partner for each of the star model fermions. Sure. So a spectrum of that sort could possibly be the spectrum of a theory that has parity in the UV, and parity would like connect this set of fermions with this set of fermions. However, we've observed the Higgs mechanism, we've observed the Higgs couplings to fermions, so we know that this set of fermions mostly get them, well, at least mostly get their masses from the Higgs, right? And so for parity to exchange those two set of fields, those guys should also take their mass from the Higgs. And we know that because of unitarity, for instance, these things tend to be too heavy. And they're basically all ruled out because of Higgs couplings and other things. So just adding these by hand, three new generations of this and trying to make them heavy would not work. So, okay, good, let's try something else. Maybe something that people have thought of a lot is to say, okay, these two fields that look, if we wanted to embed this set of fields into a parity symmetric theory, it would be nice if those two fields could be arranged in a doublet so that they look like the parity partner of the other guy. And okay, it cannot be a doublet under SU2 because we just know it doesn't happen. But what if it were a doublet under some other SU2 that would be Higgs down, well, so that together with another U1, it would be Higgs down to the U1 as hypercharged as we know it at low energies. So that would suggest a mapping between these two fields by parity, and that parity is not quite the textbook parity, but almost. It does like it does what the textbook parity would do, plus a Z2 exchange of these two gauge fields. So if you define the action of parity as the one you read in the textbook on some Dirac fermion, composed with the exchange of these two gauge fields, you'd get here a spectrum that is compatible with parity in the UV. So this is nice, and that's at the basis of these so-called left-right models, left-right symmetric models. And here we also have a built-in reason for why parity is broken, simply because the Higgsing of this part of the gauge group happens at higher scale than the Higgsing of that part of the gauge group. This is very nice. However, it's not a full UV model yet, because to write a mass for this quark that would give you the observed quark mass at low energies, you'd need the dimension 5 operator, which, for instance, can be UV completed into a CISO mechanism. It's not completely correct. It depends on the representation you choose for your Higgs fields. But for the representation that work, it happens that the masses have to be dimension 5. So what happens in practice is that people combine both IDs. Namely, you're using this trick of having this generalized version of parity that exchanges the low energy SU2 gauge group with a broken high energy SU2 right gauge group. And you use those extra fermions to do the CISO that you need to give these guys a mass. I'll try to be a bit more explicit in a couple of slides, but that's how I think most of the models, or all of the models out there, work in this category. So basically, you're introducing these extra fermions, but instead of having this set of charges, you turn these two into one, two, as you did here. So that's the basic field content and representation of the theories you're building here. Of course, now you're extending the star model. So the statement that the theta angle that is zero at some scale remains zero up to very high accuracy at lower scales needs to be checked, because it's technically a statement that only applies at the level of the standard model. So you want that a similar constellation still holds in those models. And it happens not to work in all of those extensions, despite looking quite similar to the standard model. And that paper has shown that because of a possible mixing that you have between these two guys here, you can have two loop diagrams that feed into theta at an order way stronger than the one that exists at the level of the star model. So to avoid this, well, you can. There are several ways, but one way that people have followed is to define what's called the mirror models, to consider what's called the mirror models, in which case you add an extra part to the gauge group here, an extra U1 factor, so that you really copied the full electroweak part of the star model gauge group and exchange the full electroweak part of the star model group with another part through parity. And then these hypercharges are also themselves upgraded into a pair of two hypercharges. So this one becomes 160 and this one becomes 016. So this, for instance, would remove the mixing. And this trick ensures in models like that paper here that the corrections to the theta angle are very much under control, even better than the star model. Good. So the basic architecture and symmetry structure of the models I'm going to discuss is like this. So yeah, if I've not been clear, maybe it's the right time for someone to ask a question or a comment or something. Otherwise, I'll proceed. Okay, hopefully everything is clear. Good, so yeah, the mirror world, just a schematic picture again, is we have two copies of the star model. So you have the Higgs, the electric gate group, and the Higgs prime, the electric gate group prime, the quark prime, all of them exchanged by parity. So if you look at this, yeah, you have a basically a doubling of the star model field content, a doubling of the star model field content at the electric level, and I've not written it down, but also the same happens for the Higgs. So here, this should not be thought of as some kind of higher dimensional picture, despite the confusing way I chose to represent it. It's really like two sets of fields living in the same 4D space. They're just two sectors that have different gauge interactions, but that are exchanged by the action of this generalized parity. However, yeah, the only thing that doesn't make this picture exactly like it's depicted here is the presence of the gluons, because we need parity to set the theta angle to zero. So these two things are not perfect copies of one another. This is not the complete star model, and this is not a complete copy of the star model, because the gluon field is still coupling to both sectors here, which we need to ensure that parity, despite being this generalized version that exchanges fields, still sets the theta angle to zero. And then, as we said, the breaking of parity in these models come from the fact that the Higgs and the mirror Higgs have different VEVs, whereas their two VEVs should be exchanged by parity. Good. Now I can start telling you about what we've done. So what's our parity solution to the strong super problem, and what we've tried to study in this context. So what we noticed is the following: is that this picture could very trivially be the low energy limit of another picture, where now these are generally two copies of the full standard model. So you have a color group here and another color group here, and just you have some kind of bicolor mediator between the two that condenses, gets a VEV, and breaks the two color groups down to their diagonal subgroup. Okay. If the scales are arranged like this, knowing this does not matter much. I mean, it's part of a tower of EFTs above that one, but it doesn't really play any role in the solution to the strong CP problem. However, there is an interesting story, or at least there is very new phenomenology to explore. Let me comment on that in a second. If you think about the hierarchy of scales and the sequence of breaking pattern in this theory to be the following. So you could first think about breaking parity. So you give the two Higgs different VEVs, so that, for instance, the quarks or the mirror quarks here, the mirror W, the mirror Z bosons, get masses which are much larger than their standard model counterparts. But you still haven't broken the two color groups down to their diagonal. So you land onto a low energy description of that sort, where you have the standard model, some theta angle, and on the other side, you have something that is Young-Mills or Young-Mills plus a few quarks and leptons, and mirror electromagnetism, with a theta angle that happens to be non-zero, large, but precisely entirely correlated with this theta angle up to very weak quantum correction. You still have this bicolor mediator, and then there is a further step of breaking where this thing gets a VEV, and only one color group arises that connects those two sectors. So this is the thing we'll be mostly interested in. First of all, because it gives us new kind of phenomenology. Second of all, because given the Fino constraints on those models, it looks way more natural that things are arranged this way, namely the scale of parity breaking, as I will show in a moment, it is pushed to very high values, whereas this scale, the mediator scale, could be as low as a couple of TeVs. And also, yeah, something else on the aesthetic side is that we were happy to have a starting point that treats all factors of the gate group in an equal way, namely that they're all copied and exchanged by parity, and that none of them are treated differently. Of course, that's just aesthetical. You don't really have to buy that as a deep reason, but that's another aspect of this construction that we like. Good. So, okay, those were those were mostly drawings. So let me show you the details of the model a bit more. So the field content looks like it's shown here. It's a horrible table, but it's not that horrible actually. This upper left part here is just the star model case group and the star model representations. Those are just singlets. And here you have the exact same copy of this, where three become three bars, etc. So yeah, you have these two sets of field, the star model sector and the mirror sector, and you just have two copies of the star model. Okay, so that's all there is to see. And the charges are arranged in a way that parity can actually exchange that column with that column. So not only are those quarks exchanged by parity as they would in the textbook, but also this for instance, gluon field is sent into this gluon field as a textbook too, with a prime in addition in the formula. So this is nice because this parity imposes two things that are of interest here for the strong CP problem. First of all, it imposes that the bare theta angle, so the parameter of the GG dual operator of that gluon and the G prime dual operator of that gauge factor here are anti-correlated like this. But it also imposes something else, which is important if you remember that flavor invariant description of the t-tangle that I was telling you about a bit earlier. It also forces that the Yukawa matrices that couple those quarks to the Higgs and those mirror quarks to the mirror Higgs, that those Yukawa matrices have to be Hermitian conjugates of one another. And those two together ensure that the physical t-tangle, the one that is a flavor invariant, the one that is actually measurable, also has this entire correlation. And this we will need in 1 second. So it's great that this parity does the two things that we want it to do. And so here, this bicolor mediator, I'll give you explicit examples in a second, but all we need is that it's a bifundamental order parameter. That means that it has a VEV and that it has bifundamental gauge charges, and they're the SU3 and the SU3 prime. If it has that, and if the VEV happens to be proportional to the identity, which I will argue is not a tuning at all, when that happens and you take the topological density of that gauge group and the topological density of that gauge group, so these things were the epsilon nu nu, g mu nu, g rho sigma that I was writing before, the thing that couples to the theta angle. If you take these two operators and project them along the massless gluons, so you take the component of this along the massless gluons, the component of this among the massless gluons, you'll find this equality once projected along the massless gluons. So if you take this equality together with this thing, you'll find that the emergent theta angle at low energies, the one that couples to the massless gluons that we have in this model, is zero, which is what we wanted here, which is what we wanted parity to achieve in the first place. Here the spectrum, right? Let me go back to the spectrum in a second. Good. Okay, so parity seems to do what we wanted it to do. Good. So what about the FINO of that model? What about the parameter space of that model? So as I said, the Yukawa matrices are strongly correlated in the standard model and mirror sector in this way. So it means that there are very few parameters in this model. It looks like a huge model, many new fields, many new interactions, but parity is so strong here that there are actually not many new parameters. In particular, all the quark mixing, the quark mass hierarchies, etc. All of this is inherited from the star model measured values. In particular, from this relation, you can derive that the ratio of quarks, of quark masses, is fixed simply by the ratio of VEVs. So the top over top prime is the same as up over up prime, etc. So all these things are fixed once you know that ratio. Yeah. On the other hand, it imposes that that we need a very strong hierarchies between these two VEVs, because many of these guys are going to be colored at low energies because they're charged under a field that has half of its half of this field is a massless gluon. So these guys are going to couple to gluons. So we've not seen them, right? So they have to be at least as heavy as a coupled TeV. So it shows if you call that scale V prime, so if the scale of the Higgs in this extra model is called V prime, it gives you a rough bound that it should be that the breaking of parity and the Higgs mechanism in this mirror world should happen at least at 10 to the 9 GeV. So we're really discussing here a high energy model, a deep UV model. And this hierarchy of scale can be achieved in many ways, compatible with parity. At least two ways compatible with parity. It can be either achieved through soft breaking, so you softly break parity by a mass term in the Higgs potential, or you use radiative corrections as was explained in that paper here. Both of which can ensure that this value arises in the model in the way that is compatible with parity. Good, and something I'll try to stress a couple of times in the rest of that talk is that this model and these parity models, these mirror world models, despite having many new fields and many new interactions, are extremely predictive. Namely, there are very few new parameters. And basically, most of the FINO that I'm going to discuss later on is captured by two BSM scales, the scale of that Higgs, of that mirror Higgs, the scale of parity breaking V prime, and what I'll be calling V3, which is the scale at which this mediator gets surveyed here. So once you have those two scales, you can almost describe the full FINO of the model without anything else hanging, simply because parity is so strong that it tells you how the different particles, what are the masses of all the new particles, how they couple to their own Higgs, how they mix. It also tells you how strong is this gauge coupling, because it has to be the same as this one at that high energies and vice versa, et cetera. So yeah, almost everything is fixed by this section of parity. But nevertheless, you have enough freedom with these two scales to have very different FINO in the parameter space. So if V3 were much larger than V prime, we'd land on models that have already been built as an effective field theory, the IR, where the lightest particles would be some of those fermions. However, in the other direction, you'd get completely different FINO. So for instance, you would get colored bosons as the lightest BSM states. But playing with these two, the model is predictive enough that you can play with all of the scales that matter and get and just characterize, classify the full phenomenology, but you have enough freedom to cover different FINO, which is cool.
So why do you say everything is fixed by the two parameters? So why not everything?
Sorry, can you say it again?
You said several times that almost everything is fixed by V3 and V5. So why almost? Why not everything?
Because of the next slide, it's true of everything I depicted here. It's not true of this bicolored mediator. Yeah. So the bicolored mediator. We've discussed two options. Okay, let me try to answer your question here and in the next slide. The bicolored mediator can be various things, and we've discussed in our work. We consider these two options. So either the scalar. Or if you don't like it because it, for instance, it introduces a new hierarchy problem in the game that you would like to avoid because you're trying to solve an HNS problem, you can do it with strongly interacting fermions getting condensating and breaking some symmetry. So in the first instance, that of the scalar, what you need is some kind of bifundamental scalar that could be a 3-3 or a 3-3 bar of those two gauge groups. And the most general potential at the renormalizable level of that guy looks like this. So none of these parameters is fixed to something by parity, except maybe this one to a real value, I think. Yeah. Otherwise, all the other ones are free. So these things are additional parameters, which I think what I was saying before is still true, namely that there is still interesting FINO that I can plot in the 2D space, as I'll try to show you in a couple slides. It's just that this sector introduces new constraints that cannot be expressed in this two-dimensional parameter space and cannot be only expressed when you have this couple of new parameters determined. If you take that scalar, these people here worked out that the vacuum happens to break those two SU3 down to the diagonal SU3 in a very large fraction of parameter space. So it's not a tuning to assume that the VEV is taken to be the identity as I was describing earlier. And the good thing is that this sector does not introduce further P or CP breaking that would spoil the conclusion I presented about the theta angle being zero at low energy. Another way of proceeding of breaking this of breaking the two SU3 down to one is to use strongly interacting fermions a la Technicolor. So for instance, the set of charges, it's not unique. We've had other, we discussed other cases in the paper, but one thing that works is to have the following. So this set of fermions, two confining gauge group, which are related by parity, and these two SU3, which are related by parity, which are the two SU3 of the star model and star model prime, and fermions which have these different charges. So if this thing gets strong, if these two things get strong, at a much higher scale than these guys, these fermions are going to condense according to the pattern dictated here and will break the two SU3, because they're going to form condensates, which are chiral under these two symmetries. So for instance, how parity acts depends on whether you choose this 3 prime here to be 3 or 3 bar. If this is a 3, then parity has to exchange those two lines in addition of exchanging those two gauge groups and those two gauge groups. If 3 prime is taken to be a 3 bar, then it's exchanging those two lines. So the FINO is slightly different depending on those choices. You also can work your way out with a single SUN. I'm not going into these details, but just, yeah, that there are models of that sort, which naturally generates a scale of breaking V3 as low as you like without new hierarchy problem. And also that do generate the pattern you want, namely that this is broken to the diagonal SU3 and not to something else, not to something smaller, for instance. Good. So I was telling you earlier that whenever you build a parity or CP solution to the strong CP problem and you start introducing new fields and new interactions, you have to check whether those new fields and new interactions maintain the fact that theta is 0, even way below the scale of parity breaking here. So this has to be checked. One cannot just rely on the star model result because we're not actually dealing with the star model. We're dealing with the star model at low energies, but not at the threshold, at the matching scale, for instance. So things have to be checked there. And here we don't have the good thing in these parity models is that the two sectors are quite decoupled and the few mediators that we have are not capable of mediating CP variation that much. So for instance, here, the only mediators that we have are gluons, this bicolor mediator, or the heavy Higgs, none of which can mediate the CP variation in a very efficient way. So because the only way of mediating CP variation is through the CKM phase. Because here we have a parameter theta that breaks both parity and CP. So to generate it, you need to have a graph that breaks both parity and CP. If you write a Feynman graph that happens to preserve CP, it doesn't matter that it breaks parity because it cannot generate theta. So here, despite dealing with the parity solution, it's still useful to think about the different CP phases that you have in the model. And there happen to be two correlated CKM phases in the two sectors. Long story short, the only thing that you can check that the only diagrams that could possibly contribute to the theta angle are very small. Namely, there are at least 3 loops. And we don't know if the 3-loop one vanishes, but at least the three loop ones can be drawn. An interesting aspect of that model that was not present in other models is that we now have 2 color groups and we have a large non-zero theta angle at high energy. So if you remember, we have these 2 color groups that have 2 large theta angles, just which are opposite of one another at high energies. So that means that there is CP variation in the form of that large theta angle at high energies. This large theta angle is just not coupling to the massless gluons. And what that means is that there are non-perturbative contributions that are called small instantons. So the heavy gluons that arrive from the Higgsing of the two SU3 down to a single SU3 can take instanton-like configuration and mediate CP variation. But this we've checked that they never contribute in the part of parameter space that is relevant for FINO, namely that is not yet excluded by something else like LHC constraints. Good. About those constraints, actually, let me show you this plot, which basically shows the constraints on the model. So here, let me go back to the question we had 2 slides ago, namely this plot is a 2D plot, and it's actually it's not a projection of a larger plot in many dimensions, depending on many parameters. It's an actual plot of there's no better plot of V' and on the V' and V3 space. There are some additional model dependent constraints that can be added on top of that I'll show you in a second, but those are always here. They are the constraints on the model. So we've drawn a couple of them. So here, one could think about this as a rather speculative constraint, but you can write EFTO parallels, like you expect that some new physics is going to show up at some scale. Could be the Planck scale, as we've assumed, could be the good scale, but okay, we've assumed the Planck scale here. And you can write effective operators that once parity is broken, shift the theta angle. So once you break parity, for instance, here, this wave is going to remain, and this one is going to be extremely small, and you're going to have a contribution to the theta angle that does not satisfy the principle according to which the two theta angles are opposite in the DPUV. So if you want those things to be controlled, the parity breaking scale can be too large cannot be too large when compared to the Planck scale, and that's this bound here. Everything above here would be ruled out by this constraint. The red thing is another instance of the fact that everything is predicted in this model almost. Namely, if I give you those two values of V prime and V3, the RGs and the mass matrices are all known, and the RGs of the different gauge couplings are known. So for instance, if I tell you that V prime, the scale of parity, the scale of this mirror Higgs is 10 to the 9 GeV, and I give you either of these two values of V3, you can just plot the RGs of the two strong gauge group. So this red region are the values for which the second strong coupling would blow up before we do the Higgsing, and therefore the whole mechanism would not work because we assumed some kind of weakly coupled Higgsing to occur here. And those two things are actually exclusion bound, so LHC searches, so in the present context. So those are searches for the heavy gluons that we get from the Higgsing that are just heavy vector octets of the color groups, I mean, that can be that are extremely easily produced and decay to quarks. So this thing requires that the scale of Higgsing is not too low. And those are just exclusion searches for the additional fermions, which would appear at the LHC as stable color neutral particles. So those are bounds that do not depend on the coupling of the bifundamental mediator that I was telling you. So these things really depend only on these two scales. Of course, you can lay in addition on top of this plot some constraint that depend now on what actually is the mediator and what kind of model it has and what are the parameters. So here I've been extremely schematic about them. Don't take that too seriously. I'm just wanted to stress that those constraints can be added on top of that plot, but they won't change that plot. They won't change what's beneath, which really depends on those two scales.
May I ask, do you need to do barogenesis? What scale do you need to do barogenesis?
Sorry, what scale? I mean, we don't have a barogenesis mechanism in this model at the moment, so it's not doing barogenesis. We've not tried to make it work, let's say. So there is no scale of biogenesis at the moment.
Can you give me like a way, maybe like a how this would be compatible? Because in the end, I actually generated the 10 minus 10, right? In your framework.
Sorry, can you say it again?
I need to generate the baryon number.
So you would have to add some. You'd have to add something on top of this model. You should try to add, you know, leptogenesis on top of that model or something like this. Yeah, we've not worked this out exactly here. I mean, I know people like Lorenz have said this in the context of other kind of mirror world models, not in the context of that model. So I'm. I think it should be doable. I've not tried to do it in detail, but I don't see what would go wrong if you were to try.
If you do something like at scales below V prime, do you regenerate because
that's the angle you mean?
Regenerate some CP violation phases.
I mean, I think you could. I mean, yeah. If you were to do some mirror version of leptogenesis in this, I don't think it would spoil the strong CP problem solution. I've not thought about it too deeply, but I think it's okay. So you'd get. I mean, let's say you get new CP phases in the lepton sector. I don't think it. I think there are models where it does not jeopardize the whole construction.
Yeah. So does it introduce new baryons in the mirror sector too? Do you need to control the spaces?
You do, yeah, you do. That's also something you have to do. That's right. You have to ensure. Sorry.
Yeah. Should I expect asymmetry like in the mirror sector as well?
Dangerous? Maybe, yeah. Yes, it's yeah. In principle you would expect parity to to relate the two sectors, right? So you would expect parity to generate, well, to have at least to allow one cosmological history will generate both asymmetries. However, the scales are very different, right? So you could easily fit inflation in between, or you could, and also the neutrinos are behaving in a funny way, because if you have a dimension 5 Majorana mass for neutrinos, or if you're doing a CISO of some sort, this relation I was showing some time ago, this thing here, the ratio of quark masses, this thing does not hold for leptons. Oh, sorry, it holds for electrons, but it doesn't hold for neutrinos. For charged leptons, but not for neutrinos. So there is a quadratic relation. So neutrinos are doing something a bit funky. So I could imagine. Okay. All I'm saying is that one has to work it out. I think you can play with the hierarchy of scales, and you could also play with the fact that neutrinos behave differently, so that they do something much earlier on in the early universe in the mirror sector, and much later in our sector, or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. But okay, don't. Yeah, it's not. I've not worked this out very. I just think it. I expect that something could be done, at least using inflation as an excuse. Yeah. But yeah, it's still it definitely would be worth doing. Sorry, my laptop is taking things slow. Okay. Good. Yeah. Are there further questions on this before I? I spend a couple of minutes on the dark matter side of the story. Okay, good. So far everything. So this was all about our first paper, just the solution to strong CP, and we've had a follow up where we asked the question: Can there be an actual dark matter candidate in this setup? Hoping that maybe something as nice as for the axion happens, and you'd get for free a dark matter candidate in this model. So it does work to some extent, definitely not as nicely as for the axion, but in this model, you have many new particles, and parity dictates that you have also accidental baryon and lepton number in the mirror world. So, okay, everything is there to have dark matter candidates. And actually only one is viable, that's the mirror electron. The other ones are all heavy, the other ones are all unstable, and would decay to the mirror electron or the mirror up quark. So there's the mirror electron is the lightest one with the lepton number charge. The mirror up quark has a mirror baryon number charge, and is the only stable one. However, it's completely ruled out as dark matter candidate, simply because it's gonna hadronize and form exotic hadrons with a way too large cross section to be dark matter in these models. Simply because they're charged under two SU3s in two different SU3s, like a nuclear matter and this extra up quark would be charged under two different SU3s in the deep UV, but not in the IR. So this thing would really look like an exotic stable quark as dark matter. You also have neutrinos, but neutrinos, as I was saying, they have a different relation. I mean, the ratio of neutrino to electron mass, for instance, is not constant in this model. It's enhanced. It takes a kick of V prime over V in the mirror sector. So in the kind of parameter space we're looking at, the neutrinos are actually heavier than the electron. So they would decay to, they can decay to the electron here.
So what is the lightest color state in your model? Is it gluons?
Depends on the scales. It's either the octet gluon or the, there are several actually. You have the heavy gluons that arise from the Higgsing. You have everything that comes from the bifundamental sector that could be light, and you have the mirror up quark. So the mirror up quark has a mass that is captured by V prime times the up Yukawa roughly up to Rining, and the other guys have masses that is captured by V3. So the gluon has a mass that is also lowered by the strong coupling, whereas the bifundamental sector is expected to be slightly heavier, but it depends. In the case where we have, for instance, this technicolor-like construction, we have dark pion, mediator pions, if you like, that are also light. So yeah, it depends. It depends on the model, depends on the choice you make for the bifundamental. The But as a dark matter candidate, for instance, the heavy gluons don't work, right? The heavy gluons decay to quarks immediately, have other one couplings to quarks, our quarks, I mean. So those would not work.
Do they mutate quickly enough, though?
Yeah. They're TV-ish in mass, and they have strong coupling. They basically have a G strong as a coupling to the quarks. Yeah, I think that's okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we've been working. So the goal is to get this mirror electron as a dark matter candidate. That's the only one that possibly makes sense in this model. However, because of the strong bound on the mirror up quark, and this thing I've been telling you about several times, namely that you cannot choose those masses freely. Parity tells you that if you know the mass of the mirror electron, it's roughly YE times V prime, so the Yukawa coupling of the electron times V prime. Then you almost know what the mirror up quark mass is. So if you make this one, you have to be very careful because this one is lurking very close by in mass. So for instance, if you have like a temperature large enough so that you can easily make this guy, you're gonna easily make this guy too. So yeah, sorry for that reason that masses are fixed by parity. So for instance, this is the same kind of plot as I was showing. Here you're fixing V prime to be 10 to the 9 GeV, and you take, for instance, here two values of V3. And you can compute the ratio mu prime over mu prime. There's nothing else you can fix than those two scales. So for instance, here for this value, let's say 10 to the 5 GeV for V3 and 10 to the 9 GeV for V prime, you get a ratio slightly above 2 for these things. So the masses are fixed by parity. And for this reason, for instance, you cannot do freeze out. The parameter spaces where freeze out would give you the right yield for the electron would give you a yield for the U prime that's way above those bounds. By the way, I should say that those bounds have some interesting large uncertainty associated to them, but I think it's even when you're very generous with the uncertainty, you're still completely off. And for that reason, I think the earlier literature tried something else to get dark matter. So either non-thermal mechanisms like inflaton decaying to preferably our sector and preferably to the mirror electron and the mirror up quark and things like this. People have considered the other dark matter candidates like Miller neutrinos that could work, or even added some additional particles to these kind of constructions. But what we've realized is that there is one thermal scenario that does work. It's quite tuned, but it does work. It's this sequential freezing that happens through the mirror photon. Namely, we're first freezing in the mirror photon through this U prime portal. So we are now in at temperatures where none of these particles are naturally present. We only have standard model degrees of freedom. And the our gluons can couple to U prime, and at loop level, this generates mirror photons. So what does work is to freeze in those mirror photons and have them rescatter so that through rescattering they produce these E primes. They can certainly also rescatter and give you U primes, and these gluons can actually directly give you U primes through just the tri-level couplings. But now, since we are doing freezing and we have a ratio that can be between the mass that can be something like 2, we can find ranges of reheating temperature where these guys are produced with an exponential suppression and these guys are produced with the square of that exponential suppression, so to say, so that this bound is still satisfied. So that does work.
Are the mirror photons exactly massless, or do they have a mass in this?
They're exactly massless here, yeah.
And do you get any kind of kinetic mixing between them and the regular photons?
Good. Let me answer that in one slide. That's something we have. Let me mention. Okay, there are two things that may not be. Well, I don't know. There are several things that may not be too copying to you, I don't know, but at least, yeah, one thing that I should mention out of honesty is that for this to work, we need to have, we need inflation to do the right thing, namely we needed to have the reheat temperature kind of correlated with this mass, although they in principle have nothing to do in common, nothing to do with one another. And we also require inflation to be reasonably quick, because if there was during inflation some large temperature, that's this larger temperature, we could possibly make U primes. So we do, for this to work, we do need inflation to play our game nicely, which is definitely not guaranteed here. But the second thing in relation to your question is that we have, yeah, we do have. Okay, I'll comment that plot. I'll tell you about that plot in detail in a second. But to answer your question, this gray region here is what is excluded from direct detection, and this direct detection is driven by the kinetic mixing. So if kinetic mixing were order one, this thing would be fully gray. There would be, well, I don't know if it would be fully, it probably would be fully gray. What we've been assuming, the thing that we also need to assume something else, which is that there is a value in the DPUV where kinetic mixing is zero. And that does not follow from Pare. That follows from, let's say, expecting unification, gauge unification to happen to and map to something like SU5 times SU5 prime or something like this, where this kinetic mixing would be absent. But this is an extra assumption we have to make. It does not follow from parity. Parity would allow this kinetic mixing. Yeah.
Just quickly, if you can wrap up in 5-10 minutes.
Maybe. I'm almost done. I think, yeah, that's my, this and the next overlays would be my last slide, yeah. Good. Yeah. So let me take a step back and explain what that plot is, and we'll come back to the kinetic mixing. Okay. So here, forget about the red thing. Sorry, I just took that from our paper where we have some further discussion about this red region, but I don't want to enter into this. So everything which is which is white, and this part of the red is just that there's no reheating temperature that works. Namely, no matter what the reheating temperature is, either we have too little dark matter or we have too much of the U primes. So model, yeah, dark matter story doesn't work in this region. These regions here, the blue and green regions do work. Namely, there is a reheating temperature. We have a small amount of U primes and the right yield for the mirror electron. There are two regions because we allowed ourselves to saturate the experimental uncertainties on the value of mu. So fixing mu, our mu, namely the up quark mass as we measure it, we can use parity, use the RGEs to get what the mirror up quark should be in this two dimensional parameter space with v prime and v three. Once you fix mu, our mu, you'd get what mu prime is. So if you make it if this is made slightly heavier by saturating the current experimental uncertainties, you make the mirror up prime slightly heavier, not exactly by 20%, but something of that sort. And that's when you open up the parameter space a tiny bit. Anyway, so that's what you're seeing. And yeah, this comes from some domain walls you may have from the bifundamental scalars that would ruin your cosmology. But this thing here that I really want to focus on is the exclusion from direct detection. So as I was saying, here we are assuming that there is a scale at which there is no kinetic mixing, for instance, motivated by unification. But nevertheless, there is a direct detection bound simply because there is there are loop diagrams that are going to regenerate this kinetic mixing. So this thing is the exclusion bound, assuming the minimalistic amount of kinetic mixing you get in this model, except, of course, having a small bare parameter that cancels again this loop thing that could, but we've assumed zero kinetic mixing at high energy and this kinetic mixing being regenerated at loop level. Before I show you that, sorry. One interest, like small, a weak interest of having low V3, of having the V3 in this picture, and namely having two gauge groups. One interest is that it makes the up quark mass run slightly sharp. The running of the up quark mass is slightly sharper, so that we have these spiky features that would, and it flattens out a bit below if we go to large V3. So this is allowed. This comes from the running. So we have larger couplings because of the small V3s. But yeah, the true interest in our model of having this low V3 is that it naturally suppresses these loop corrections to the kinetic mixing. It does not suppress the bare kinetic mixing you could put at high scale, but it does suppress the additional loop contributions to it. Namely, in a region where, well, if the parameter space is such that this holds, so namely V prime is not too large, so that mu prime is not too large, and this inequality holds. So in this region, you have this for loop diagram that allows to connect a photon to a mirror photon, It's four loops, but remarkably, it's still large enough if you estimate it to completely rule out the model as a dark matter model. However, if you go to the other limit, so in the limit where V prime is large enough in comparison in comparison with V3, so that this inequality holds here, so that region here. This diagram does not exist in the deep UV. So this quark couples to mirror gluons, and this quark couples to gluons. So you need other loops or something here of the bifundamental field to actually connect those two plates. In this limit, you even pinch that loop off and have an effective operator even before the diagram exists, bringing further suppression. All in all, that means that in this region, basically the running starts at V3 and is extremely weak. So that's why this thing disappears and opens up a region that would not exist otherwise if you had not introduced V3 or if you had sent it to the deep UV, much above the scale of party breaking relevant for construction. Good. Okay, that will bring me to my outlook. Good. So the messages I wanted to you take home is that we've studied some priority solutions to the trunk CP problem, which I think is the first in the complete mirror world. I mean, in the mirror world where the full star model gauge group is copied and related to its copy with parity. But okay, beyond that model, I think something I wanted to discuss is that there are certainly many new models that people have not thought of in this. This is a rather unexplored territory, I think, in the solution of the strong CP, in the landscape of solutions to strong CP, and there are many lessons left to learn. So this, beyond that very model, what we wanted to do is to further explore that phenol and see what's out there and what could be there, in particular if we have to understand beyond axion solution to the strong CP problem. So for instance, one lesson is that there is room, not the most convincing room, but nevertheless, there is room for a thermal dark matter candidate in this landscape. And yeah, so there are very few parameters, but nevertheless, it's a good thing because the model is predictive and it's still enough parameters to allow very different physics in the parameter space that can be explored. So for instance, colored bosons at colliders or maybe possible companion dark matter signals, either from direct detection or from exotic hadrons hanging around. Okay, well, with this, thank you.
Questions? I have one, very, very naive, so I'm a bit confused. So this dark mirror photon, this mirror photon is like completely massless, and it's like the electric charge of the electron is like the same of the electric charge coupling in the standard model, right? Because everything is the same. So like, do you expect to have some cosmological signatures due to the fact that you have like this sort of tightly coupled fluid like in the dark sector? Like, the question is like not specific to your model, it's more like to this sort of mirror solution where you have a massless dark photon. So yeah, do you expect your dark matter to be to have like dark BO or some specific feature?
Okay, so it depends on the coupling. So here, certainly if the the production mechanism that we've discussed is through like nothing is in thermal equilibrium except our standard model, right? So in our picture, the dark photon is frozen in, it never reaches thermal equilibrium, but it freezes in the mirror electron. So there is no thermal equilibrium within the mirror sector, right? So there's never a coupled fluid, right? In the limit we take, there is no decoupling of E prime from its own thermal bath, for instance. Okay, so it's a different kind of physics. I don't think we could make dark matter. I think we would always get too many U primes if we were to do that. So we don't have that picture in mind. We don't have that picture of a mirror fluid that is self-interacting and with its own temperature and stuff.
You have density. You have a high density, right? At earlier time.
It's not that.
It doesn't have to be hot.
But it's not in thermal equilibrium. This we know.
It doesn't have to be in thermal equilibrium. The plasma effect is there, like no matter if it is a cold or like in a metal, it has some effect, plasma effect.
What kind of effects are we talking about?
Oh, just like plasma oscillations. you have a dense medium, you have a long range force. You don't need to have a somewhat equilibrium.
I cannot answer to that with numbers. I'm sorry, we've not studied that. But our dark matter is basically as heavy as a WIMP, right? It can be heavier, but it's in the T, so several of one. Even heavier than it would, right? It's in the tens of TeV's regime, so it's not that dense. But okay, I don't know how dense you need for that to happen. Sorry, I've never studied this, so I can't really answer.
Oh, as long as the plasma frequency is bigger than the size of the universe.
But what kind of density do you need for this to be relevant?
I think like for charge one, like it's probably like any density.
You mean you also expect like dissipative effects, right? That as these particles are accelerating, they can radiate dark photons because they're massless and you know, they're bound on like halo morphology.
I missed the first words you said.
So you have a massless mediator, you have dissipative effects.
Oh, right.
The dark matter can radiate and that changes the morphology of the halo compared to like a non-dissipative dark matter.
Yeah. Yeah, this we checked, and I think for the kind of masses we have in mind, it seems to be irrelevant. I mean, this we took from the literature, so I cannot do it on the back of an envelope. But I think, yeah, for these 10-ish TeVs, maybe a couple of TeVs dark matter, it seems to be, and the coupling of that size, namely 1/137 or something like this, it seems to be irrelevant. I mean, you're not making your halos collapse into disks and things like this.
So further question from Zoom. If not, we can thank the speaker again.
Thank you.